Part 2. Empire. 1973 through 1983. Chapter 6. Bleeding on the Page. 1973 through 1976. I don't have a natural talent for writing, George Lucas confessed to Filmmaker's Newsletter in 1974. When I sit down, I bleed on the page, and it's just awful. Writing just doesn't flow in a creative surge the way other things do. No other project would make Lucas bleed more than Star Wars. For nearly 3 years, he would agonize over plots and characters, plumbing science fiction novels, folklore, comic books, and movies for inspiration. He would struggle through draft after draft, writing and rewriting, lifting scenes and subplots he liked from earlier drafts, fussing with the spellings of planets and characters, and trying to make sense of an ever-expanding script that was starting to spin out of his control. And time again, he would find both friends and studio executives baffled by his story, skeptical he could ever get any of it on film. Lucas would treat the writing of Star Wars as a full-time job, trudging up the stairs to his writing room each morning at 9 a.m., where he would then lower himself slowly into his wooden desk chair and stare at a blank page for hours, waiting for the words to come. I sit at my desk for 8 hours a day no matter what happens. Even if I don't write anything, he explained. It's a terrible way to live, but I do it. I sit down and I do it. I can't get out of my chair until 5 o'clock or 5:30. It's like being in school. It's the only way I can force myself to write. Over his desk, he hung a wall calendar to track his progress, vowing to write 5 pages daily and marking off each day with a big, dramatic X. On a good day, he might have 1 page completed by 4 p.m. Then, with an eye on the clock, he would scramble to write the 4 remaining pages over the next hour. If he could finish his pages early, he would permit himself to knock off for the rest of the day and maybe reward himself with a bit of music from one of his most prized possessions, a glowing, garish, fully functional 1941 Wurlitzer jukebox, which Lucas had loaded with his own collection of rock and roll 45s. As the Diamond's Little Darlin' wailed from the Wurlitzer's throbbing speakers, Lucas would kick back in his chair, tennis shoes off and shirt tail untucked, lost in the music and grateful to be done for the day. Most days, however, the jukebox would remain quiet, its neon lights dark, and no words would be written at all. At 5:30, he would tromp downstairs to watch the evening news with Walter Cronkite, glaring with anger over a TV dinner as he stewed about the blank pages he'd left upstairs. "You go crazy writing," Lucas said later. "You get psychotic. You get yourself so psyched up and go in such strange directions in your mind that it's a wonder that all writers aren't put away someplace." It could be said that Star Wars was partly Coppola's fault. In late 1972, with American Graffiti in post-production, Lucas was ready to begin work on his next project, which he was convinced would be Apocalypse Now. For Lucas, the fact that Coppola still owned the film was just a technicality. All Francis did is take a project I was working on, put it in a package deal, and suddenly he owned it, groused Lucas. As far as he was concerned, intention was 9/10 of the law, and he fully intended to make Apocalypse his next film, sending the script around to several studios, and to his surprise, pretty much got a deal at Columbia. In November, then, Gary Kurtz was dispatched to the Philippines and Hong Kong to scout suitable locations. "And we were all ready to go," said Lucas. Ready, that is, until Columbia, still trying to ink an agreement, began to haggle over percentages. Coppola refused to hand over any of his own interest in the film. If Columbia wanted a larger piece of the movie, they were going to have to take it out of Lucas's share. "My points were going to shrink way down," complained Lucas, "and I wasn't going to do the film for free." Lucas would cede Apocalypse Now back to Coppola, at least for the moment, but he wasn't happy about it. "Francis had a right to do it. It's in his nature," Lucas said later. "But at the same time, I was annoyed about it." Had Coppola chosen to negotiate instead of digging in his heels, Lucas's next project might very well have been Apocalypse Now, and Star Wars would have continued to be a contractual add-on, to be developed at a later time, perhaps, or perhaps not at all. Instead, Lucas grudgingly abandoned the project, grumbling about Coppola's stinginess. Star Wars, then, would be spawned by Lucas's need to fill both a creative and a financial void. "I was in debt," Lucas recalled later. "I needed a job very badly. I didn't know what was going to happen with American Graffiti." With Apocalypse Now shelved, Lucas turned to his only other viable project, the one still embedded in his two-picture deal with Universal. "I figured, what the heck, I've got to do something," said Lucas. "I'll start developing Star Wars." Only at this point, it wasn't Star Wars, not even close. As Lucas sat down to write in his little office in Mill Valley in February 1973, all he had was the merest spark of an idea. After a skeptical King Features had declined to sell him Flash Gordon, Lucas decided he could just as easily make up his own characters in a similar vein. "It's your basic superhero in outer space," he explained. "I realized that what I really wanted to do was a contemporary action fantasy." As would become his habit, Lucas began the writing process by making lists of names and locations for his fantasy, scrawling "Emperor Ford Xerxes VII, a suitably heroic-sounding name, at the top of one of his notebook pages, followed by single names like Owen, Mace, Biggs, and Valorum. After trying various combinations, Lucas then divided his list into names of characters and planets, giving each a brief title or description. Luke Skywalker was on the list from the very start, but he was Prince of Bebbers, while Han Solo was Leader of the Hubble People. The planets Alderaan and Yavin were there too, as were locations named after Herald Square and the Japanese actor Toshiro Mifune. Next, Lucas began inserting his names and places into a short narrative, not much more than a story fragment, called The Journal of the Whills. He envisioned borrowing a storytelling device from the old Disney cartoons, showing a storybook, in this case The Journal of the Whills, falling open in the opening moments of the movie to emphasize that whatever story followed came from a book, he told an interviewer. "This is the story of Mace Windu," wrote Lucas, underlining the name for emphasis, "a revered Jedi Bendu of Opuchi, as related to us by C.J. Thorpe, Padawan learner of the famed Jedi." Over two densely written pages, Lucas crammed in plenty of names and backstory, and was only just starting to wind himself into the barest hint of a plot. His heroes were summoned at the desolate second planet of Yoshiro by a mysterious courier from the chairman of the Alliance. When he trailed off practically in mid-sentence, already out of gas, it was a non-starter, and Lucas knew it. So he began again, making another list of names, scribbling out bits of plots and scenes he knew he wanted to include. "One of the key visions I had of the film when I started was of a dogfight in space with spaceships, two ships flying through space, shooting each other. That was my original idea. I said, I want to make that movie. I want to see that." Trying to get the dogfight in his head down on paper was difficult, however, so Lucas began taping old war movies on television, compiling footage of airplane battles from films like The Bridges at Tokori and Tora Tora Tora. "I just edited it according to my story," he said later. It was really a way of getting a sense of movement of the spaceships. Eventually, he would have more than 20 hours of tape, which he would transfer to 16mm film, then tightly edit down to a reel about 8 minutes long. "I would have the plane going from right to left," explained Lucas, "and a plane coming toward us and flying away from us to see if the movement would generate excitement." While he didn't know it yet, the reel of dogfighting, swooping, tail-spinning aircraft would be one of the most important bits of film he would ever put together. The wet concrete he would pour into the mold for the cornerstone of his own film empire. On April 17th, Lucas began writing another treatment, this one titled The Star Wars. This draft contained the dogfight in space that Lucas wanted to see, as well as a more fully realized plot that channeled bits of Flash Gordon and Kurosawa's The Hidden Fortress. Lucas poured everything he had ever loved about the Saturday morning serials into his treatment, with plenty of chases, close scrapes, exotic creatures, and general derring do. From The Hidden Fortress, he borrowed a few key plot points, namely, a princess being escorted through enemy territory by a wise and battle-scarred general, and, more important, two bumbling, bickering bureaucrats to serve as comic relief. Luke Skywalker makes his first appearance, though in this early draft, he's an aged general guarding a young princess on the planet Aqualay. He and the princess meet two squabbling bureaucrats who have escaped from an orbiting space fortress, and the four of them travel to a spaceport to find a pilot to take them to the planet Opuchi. Skywalker, handy with a laser sword, recruits and trains a band of 10 boys to be warriors before escaping the planet in a stolen ship. There's a dogfight. There would always be a dogfight. A chase through an asteroid field, and a crash on Yavin, a planet of giant furry aliens. The princess is captured, and Skywalker leads an assault on the Imperial prison, escaping amid yet another spectacular dogfight. There's an award ceremony, and there would always be an award ceremony as well, where the princess is revealed as her true goddess self. Even at 14 handwritten pages, this rather busy proposal still seemed too vague to Lucas. But he nonetheless had it bound in a black leather binder with the Star Wars in Boston gold on the cover, and gave it to Agent Jeff Berg to take to United Artists for a look. Berg confessed that he didn't understand a word of it, and didn't really know how to pitch it. Lucas did, even if his description was all over the place. "It's a space opera in the tradition of Flash Gordon and Buck Rogers," he explained. "It's James Bond and 2001 combined. Super fantasy. Capes and swords and laser guns and spaceships shooting each other, and all of that sort of stuff. But it's not camp," he insisted. "It's meant to be an exciting action-adventure film." For Lucas, enthusiasm always trumped clarity. On May 7th, Berg brought Lucas's treatment to United Artists, putting it in the hands of David Chasman, the same executive who had believed in American Graffiti. Lucas knew the treatment he was giving to Chasman was a lot to comprehend. Getting the images in his head to come through on the page would always be difficult. So he had included 10 pages of illustrations to try to convey the look and feel of what he had in mind. Photos of NASA astronauts, amphibious tanks, and drawings of space heroes clipped from comic books. Chasman was intrigued, but he was also on his way to Cannes, and promised Berg he'd review the materials and be in touch shortly. It took 3 excruciating weeks for Chasman to wire his answer, "No." Glumly, Lucas asked that Berg submit the proposal to Ned Tannen at Universal. "I hated Universal," said Lucas, "but I had to go to them. Part of my deal to make American Graffiti was that I had to sign my life over to them for 7 years. They owned me." Making things worse, Lucas and Tannen were still bickering over Graffiti, which Tannen was demanding be recut even as Lucas was approaching the studio, hat in hand, with a proposal for his next film. "It was right in the middle of Ned's most angry period," said Lucas's attorney, Tom Pollock. "It was not submitted with enthusiasm." Nevertheless, Berg dutifully sent the treatment over to Tannen in early June, promising the film could be made on the cheap. Lucas grudgingly described it as a $6 million idea, which I'll make for $3 million. Like Chasman before him, Tannen took the binder from Berg and promised he'd be in touch shortly. Even as Tannen was ruminating, Berg had begun an informal discussion with 20th Century Fox and the studio's new vice president for creative affairs, Alan Ladd Jr. Laddie, as he was called by nearly everyone, was the son of actor Alan Ladd. Show business was in his blood, and he had an intuitive feel for commercial hits, as well as an appreciation for talent, no matter how quirky. He had recently rescued writer-director Mel Brooks from a panicky Warner Brothers after the studio had lost faith in the unreleased Blazing Saddles, and Berg thought Ladd might appreciate both the talent and travails of his own client, who was fighting a similar creative battle with Universal over the still unreleased American Graffiti. Over drinks one afternoon, Berg offered to show Graffiti to Ladd and sent a smuggled print to his office. "I saw it on the Fox lot at 9 one morning, and it absolutely bowled me over," recalled Ladd. "That's when I just said to Jeff Berg that I'd like to meet George and hear about what ideas he's working on." Lucas flew to Los Angeles, eager for the conversation. More than any other studio at the time, Fox seemed to know what to do with science fiction. In 1968, it had released the widely popular Planet of the Apes, which it grew into a five-picture franchise. Beyond Apes, however, Fox was in need of a hit. Following the 1971 departure of mogul Darryl F. Zanuck, who had steered the company on and off since 1935, the studio was now being run by Dennis Stanfill, a former Lehman Brothers executive. More accountant than innovator, Stanfill was nevertheless savvy enough to follow a trend when he saw one. In addition to steering Planet of the Apes through its several sequels, he had successfully banked on the disaster movie fad, distributing films like The Towering Inferno and The Poseidon Adventure. But the studio was still losing money rapidly, and morale was low. "It was grim," said one Fox executive, "a very demoralizing place to go to every day." For Lucas, it must have been reminiscent of the day 6 years earlier when he walked onto the virtually abandoned Warner lot. There he had found Coppola, the supportive but stormy big brother who would encourage, inspire, and infuriate Lucas as he made his way as a young filmmaker. Now at Fox, he would find Ladd, his next big brother, advocate, and defender, who would lead him through the next stage of his career. Unlike with Coppola, however, there was little bombast in the low-key Ladd, which made him a good temperamental fit with the equally restrained Lucas. "He and I together don't make one half an extrovert," remarked Ladd. Like Lucas, Ladd didn't talk very much, and when he finally did speak, he did it so quietly and calmly that some thought he sounded eerily like the rogue computer HAL from 2001 A Space Odyssey. Though Lucas derisively referred to most Hollywood executives as used car dealers, there was something about Ladd that he liked right away. For one thing, he and Ladd both spoke the same language, film. Rather than laying out his photos of astronauts or attempting to describe the plot or mood, Lucas spoke to Ladd about the films they both loved. "This sequence is going to be like The Seahawk," he told Ladd excitedly, while other scenes would be reminiscent of Captain Blood or Flash Gordon. "I knew exactly what he was saying," said Ladd. And he liked Lucas too. "I knew from spending time with him that he was a dead honest person who knew what he was doing." Ladd was interested. But at the moment, Lucas was still contractually bound to wait for the word to come back from Universal. If Tannen and Universal said no to the Star Wars, Ladd and Fox could have it. Ladd wouldn't have to wait long. At the end of June, Universal passed. While Tannen had issues with the proposed budget, mostly he was just baffled by the proposal itself, admitting he'd had a very tough time understanding it. Berg thought that perhaps psychologically, they, executives at Universal, weren't prepared to invest in a big-budget special effects-heavy movie. More likely, they probably weren't prepared to invest in Lucas, whose still unreleased American Graffiti was being recut, and, in the minds of many at the studio, seemed destined for failure. Why in the world would they back a $3 million film by an artsy director who had likely bungled a film with a budget of $750,000? Universal's answer was no. With Universal out of the way, Lucas's agents began negotiating with Fox in earnest in mid-July, passing back and forth an 8-page memo of agreement. Lucas would receive $50,000 to write the script, $100,000 for his duties as director, and $15,000 for development of the project, with a filming budget of $3 million. The most important figure in the deal, however, was the $10,000 Lucas would receive upon signing the agreement memo. That was money that would go in his pocket immediately, and he needed it. I was so far in debt, recalled Lucas. That was why I made the deal. Without it, he said later, I don't know what I would have done. Maybe take a job. But the last desperate thing is to take a job. I really wanted to hold on to my own integrity. To Lucas, integrity would always be more important than the money, and he defiantly insisted his contract give him as much control as possible over his own film. He explicitly assigned producer duties to Gary Kurtz, gave editing to Verna Fields and Marsha Lucas, and named Walter Murch his post-production supervisor, and further stipulated that Fox couldn't assign him an executive producer or control production. I was not that willing to listen to other people's ideas. I wanted everything to be my way, Lucas said. I didn't mind getting input from the creative people around me, but not the executives. I fought for many years to make sure no one could tell me what to do. Despite his swagger, Lucas knew he had been lucky to get the deal. We had no negotiating power, recalled attorney Tom Pollock. They, Fox, were the only ones that wanted it. Part of the problem was the genre itself. While science fiction films were in the middle of a slow climb to respectability in the early 1970s, they were still seen as a risky venture. On its release in 1968, 2001: A Space Odyssey, which Lucas loved, calling it the ultimate science fiction movie, had been a critical hit but a financial failure, and would take years to turn a profit. Ladd, then, was taking a real chance on Lucas and his somewhat incoherent proposal. But unlike the skeptics at Universal, Ladd was convinced enough of Lucas's talent to make the creative leap of faith. It was a gamble, said Ladd, and I was betting on Lucas. Agreed, Lucas. Ladd invested in me. He did not invest in the movie. It didn't take long before Ladd would look positively brilliant. On August 1, 1973, as Lucas was still in the middle of negotiating his deal memo with Fox, came the release and near-overnight success of the underdog American Graffiti. Suddenly, Lucas was the hottest director in the industry. Fox executives might have worried that Lucas would attempt to leverage his newfound reputation into a higher director's fee for the Star Wars. Agent Jeff Berg was convinced they could easily negotiate a fee of $500,000. But typically, Lucas didn't want money. He wanted control. He had been burned on control by studios, said Pollock later. He really saw it first as a control issue rather than a money issue. Fox thought I was going to come back and demand millions of dollars and all these gross points, recalled Lucas. I said, I'll do it for the deal memo. But we haven't talked about things like merchandising rights and sequel rights. He would insist that those particular clauses, normally considered underbrush in a contract, remain negotiable as he and Fox moved forward with the formal contract. He would also insist that the Star Wars be produced by Lucasfilm, thereby ensuring that he could keep an eye on the bottom line and that any expenses billed against the film were really his. For, even 3 years after completing THX 1138, he was still irked with Coppola for billing Zoetrope's costs against his movie. Lucas signed the agreement memo with Fox in late August. While Fox claimed public bragging rights for landing a hot commodity, it was excitedly announced in the Los Angeles Times that Lucas had been signed to quickly complete the Star Wars, followed by the Hike-penned period piece Radioland Murders. Behind the scenes, the studio had been cautious in wording its agreement. This was only a memo, not a contract. There was no agreed-upon budget and no guarantee the film would even be made. And Fox had left itself an escape clause allowing it to back out at any time after reading the screenplay. But Lucas nonetheless set up a new company called the Star Wars Corporation to manage the financials and then had Lucasfilm formally loan the corporation his services as director. Pocketing the $10,000 he had been given on signing the agreement, Lucas set to work writing the first draft of the script, which, according to the agreement, he had promised to deliver by October 31, 1973. Lucas fretted that he'd never be able to finish on time, and in fact, he wouldn't even come close to making it, citing an infinite number of distractions. Partly, he had the success of American Graffiti to blame. With a genuine hit on his hands, Lucas, for the first time in his life, had a regular flow of income, coming in almost faster than he could figure out what to do with it. Mostly, he saved it. But he did make three large purchases, one of them personal, two of them practical. First, Lucas bought a partnership in a comic book store in New York City called Supersnipe, owned and managed by a New York University film school graduate named Edward Summer. Even though Lucas would never share his father's enthusiasm for retail, he loved browsing the rows of comics in the little shop anytime he was in New York, and he enjoyed the company of Summer, who could talk films and comics with the same ease and enthusiasm as Lucas. For the kid who had once spent summer evenings reading torn copies of Tommy Tomorrow on John Plummer's dimly lit front porch, owning a comic shop was a dream come true. On the practical side were the houses on Medway and Parkway that he purchased in San Anselmo and where he planned to draft the script for the Star Wars in earnest. If, that is, he found the time. He was enjoying overseeing the work of the carpenters and electricians as they installed the screening room and offices in the old Victorian house at Parkway. It was slowly becoming his very own clubhouse, the new headquarters for Lucasfilm Limited, and it was much more fun to work on than the script for the Star Wars. "I was restoring my office," Lucas recalled with a shrug. "Building a screening room kept me going for 9, 10 months. Lucas wasn't buying and renovating houses just so he could build his own filmmaking complex. He and Marcia were hoping to start a family. But it was difficult. Lucas had worked himself to exhaustion during the nearly 2 years it had taken to write, film, edit, and fight for American Graffiti. Writing the Star Wars was sapping his motivation and energy too, but mostly he and Marcia were simply a part too much. For much of the winter of 1973 and spring of 1974, Marcia was working on location in Los Angeles and Arizona, editing Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore for director Martin Scorsese. It was a big job, the first on which she would be the lead editor, not an assistant, and at the time she had taken it, she and George had desperately needed the money. That was no longer a concern, but now Marcia found she wanted more than just the money. She wanted to be taken seriously as a film editor, and not just as an editor of films by George Lucas. "I thought, if I'm ever going to get any real credit, I'm going to have to cut a movie for somebody besides George," said Marcia. "Because if I'm cutting for my husband, they're going to think George lets his wife play around in the cutting room." George agreed with that. George may well have agreed that Marcia needed to take on projects other than his movies. It is hard for a film editor to come home and call the director a son of a bitch when she happens to be married to him, she told the New York Times. But that didn't mean he had to like it. While Lucas could often be cool or even brusque to Marcia when they were in the same room, he would always miss her terribly when she was gone. During the months when Marcia was in Arizona, Lucas would shuttle back and forth between San Francisco and Tucson, where he would spend his days sitting on a patio, reading science fiction and fantasy novels, writing his script, and, if pressed to admit it, keeping his eye on Scorsese. While never exactly the jealous type, Lucas was hopeful his presence might at least put a damper on Scorsese's fast hands. The approach would mostly work, though it didn't necessarily keep the wily Scorsese from trying. Ultimately, however, Scorsese would respond most strongly to Marcia's talent, and would make her his editor of choice for his next two films, Taxi Driver and New York, New York. Those jobs, too, would keep Marcia away for weeks or months on end. Even as he sat in the Tucson sun, Lucas was reading all he could now, soaking up themes, tropes, and plot devices. There was Edgar Rice Burroughs' novel A Princess of Mars, whose hero, John Carter, rescues the spunky princess of the title, and E.E. Doc Smith's series of Lensman novels about super-powered space cops, a variation on Lucas's beloved Tommy Tomorrow comic books. Lucas also devoured anything written by Harry Harrison. His 1966 novel Make Room, Make Room had recently been adapted to film as Soylent Green, and Lucas particularly loved his rambunctious sci-fi comic novels like The Stainless Steel Rat and Bill, the Galactic Hero. whose title character was a frustrated farm boy. There were books on mythology and religions. Scorsese remembered Lucas reading Isaac Asimov's Guide to the Bible, as well as Sir James George Frazer's tome, The Golden Bough, A Study in Comparative Religion, and comic books like Jack Kirby's energetic, vibrant, and somewhat psychedelic New Gods, in which Orion, the hero, was the son of the villainous Darkseid. Lucas took it all in, reading books and comics, watching movies, filing away the bits and pieces he liked, discarding what he didn't. "I researched kids' movies and how they work and how myths work," Lucas said, "and I looked very carefully at the elements of films within that fairy tale genre which made them successful. I found that myth always took place over the hill in some exotic far-off land. For the Greeks, it was Ulysses going off into the unknown. For America, it was out west. The last place left over the hill is space." Even Vietnam would work its way into his thinking, a byproduct of the abandoned Apocalypse Now. "I figured that I couldn't make that film because it was about the Vietnam War," said Lucas. "So I would essentially deal with some of the same interesting concepts that I was going to use and convert them into space fantasy, so you'd have a large technological empire going after a small group of freedom fighters." As Lucas made notes for his next draft, then, the planet Aquilae was now a small independent country like North Vietnam, threatened by a neighbor or provincial rebellion. While the empire is like America 10 years from now, allowing the crime rate to rise to the point where a total control police state was welcomed by the people. This was Lucas coyly hiding his liberal politics in plain sight. "Most people," said one associate later, "have no realization that part of it, Star Wars, is about a Vietnam situation." In May 1974, nearly 8 months past his deadline, Lucas completed the rough draft of the Star Wars. At 191 scenes and 33,000 words, it was crammed full of politics and backstory. But even in this early draft, parts of it sound familiar. The main character in this draft is a young man named Anakin Starkiller, who trains to become a Jedi Bendu under 70-year-old General Luke Skywalker. There are two droids providing comic relief, one short and squat, the other a gleaming Metropolis-style robot, a reference to director Fritz Lang's Mechanical Woman in his 1926 Art Deco film. There's a huge, green-skinned monster with no nose and large gills, named Han Solo. A feisty 14-year-old Princess Leia references to laser swords and Wookiees, as well as to a tall, grim-looking general and relatively minor character named Darth Vader. And for the first time, one character bids goodbye with, "May the force of others be with you." Lucas was still holding on to elements from his first treatment that he liked, including a fight in a cantina, a chase through an asteroid belt, a rescue from a prison, and the concluding award ceremony. But he was also struggling with parts of it. He wasn't quite sure yet what the Empire was searching for, and there were still too many characters, too many locations, too many backstories to sort through. But at least it was finished. The script, with "Eyes Only" stamped playfully across the title page, went over to Alan Ladd at Fox. "It was a long time coming," said Ladd, but he liked what he read, at least what he could understand of it, and, to the likely bafflement of some Fox executives, asked Lucas to begin working on a second draft. Back Lucas went to his writing room to sit at his desk for 8 hours each day, turning a pencil over and over in his hand, staring out the window, waiting for the muse. As the son of a stationer, Lucas was picky about his writing supplies. He would use only No. 2 pencils and regular blue and green lined notebook paper. Drafts would be written out in his hunched cursive, the words growing fatter as his pencil dulled against the page. He was also carrying a little notebook with him at all times so he could write down names and ideas just as quickly as they came to him. And inspiration, it seemed, could come from anywhere. One afternoon, Marcia drove away from the house with their dog, an enormous Alaskan Malamute named Indiana, sitting happily in the passenger seat next to her, his head brushing the ceiling of the car. Lucas thought the dog, nearly as big as a person, looked like Marcia's co-pilot, an image that would eventually evolve into Chewbacca, the co-pilot of the Millennium Falcon. Another important character had found his name in a throwaway comment from Walter Murch while he and Lucas were editing American Graffiti. The two of them had devised their own system for making sense of the racks of film reels and miles of film, assigning each of the reels, dialogue tracks, and soundtracks its own identifying number. During one late-night session, Murch asked Lucas for Reel 2, Dialogue 2, but shortcut the request by asking for R2-D2 instead. Lucas loved the sound of it. The way the name sounded would always be important to him. And after handing Murch the film cans, quickly scribbled R2-D2 down in his notebook. As I was writing, I would say the names to myself, and if I had a hard time dealing with the name phonetically, I would change it, he said later. It had to do with hearing the name a lot and whether I got used to it or not. At the moment, however, it seemed he hadn't gotten used to any of them. For in July 1974, as Lucas went through his rough draft again, he suddenly decided to change nearly every name in the script. R2-D2 became simply A2. The Jedi Bendu became the Dai Nogus. Anakin Starkiller was redubbed Justin Valor. Leia became Zara. Wookiees became Jawas. Still, changing character names was the easy part. Revising the story was harder. And for weeks, Lucas would stare at his notebook, then at the typewriter page, waiting for something, anything to fire his imagination. I sit there and wait for the mail to come, he sighed. Then I sit and wait for 5 o'clock to come. Gray hairs began to fleck his beard. At times, he would snip absently at his hair with a pair of scissors, filling his trash can with the clippings. His mind wandered. I can't help but think about things other than what I'm supposed to be thinking about, he admitted. And one morning, as he thought about the old Flash Gordon movie serials that had initially inspired Star Wars, he realized that he liked plenty of other old serials, too. He was especially fond of Don Winslow of the Navy, about a naval intelligence officer who fights spies as he locates and explores a secret submarine base. Lucas liked that Winslow relied as much on his brains as his fists. I began thinking it'd be a good idea to have an archaeologist in a 1930s-style serial, Lucas said. So I'd make little notes about what it would be, who his character was, and how all that would work out. That's how I came up with the idea of Indiana Smith. That name, taken from his beloved Malamute, he would also slightly change. Progress was slow, his mood blackened. But Marcia remained upbeat and supportive, patiently bringing him his dinner in front of the television set each night, either a TV dinner or tuna sandwiches with the crusts removed, just like his mother had made them. Marcia didn't always understand exactly what was going on as the drafts progressed, but she encouraged George to keep working and to stay true to his own vision for the film. George knows who his audience is, she explained. Still, she wasn't afraid to speak her mind when she thought the script dragged or got overly confusing. I'm real hard, she admitted, but I only tell him what he already knows. George might set his mouth tightly, but he would take her suggestion seriously. As she would prove time and again that when it came to story, Marcia's instincts were almost always right. Lucas also sought the opinions of friends whom he trusted, including Milius, the Hikes, and Coppola. Lucas was genuinely interested in their comments, flying down to Los Angeles with nothing more than deodorant and a change of underwear so he could spend the night talking over his pages with the Hikes. He'd take his notes and he'd go and visit all his friends, said Hike. Then he'd fly back home and rewrite Star Wars some more. Most of them still found the script incomprehensible. Coppola, however, offered few changes. I thought it was terrific, he reassured Lucas. In fact, Lucas and Coppola's relationship was warming again. In an interview published in Film Quarterly that spring, Lucas described their relationship in genuinely affectionate, almost brotherly terms. We more or less work together as collaborators. We can bounce ideas off each other because we're totally different. I'm more graphics filmmaking, editing oriented, and he's more writing and acting oriented. So we complement each other, and we trust each other, explained Lucas. Half the time he says I'm full of shit, and half the time I say he's full of shit. It's not like a producer telling you that you have to do something. Francis will say, cut that scene out, it doesn't work at all. And I may say, no, you're crazy, that's my favorite scene, I love it. And he'll say, okay, what do I care? You're an idiot anyway. Actually, he calls me the stinky kid. He says, you're a stinky kid, do what you want. And I say the same thing to him. It works very well, because you really need somebody to test ideas on, and you get a piece of expert advice that you value. Another friend whose opinion he valued was Steven Spielberg, whose company Lucas was enjoying more and more. In the summer of 1974, Spielberg was at work on Jaws for Universal, a project that would feature a gigantic mechanical shark that was still being constructed in a North Hollywood hangar. One afternoon, Spielberg took Lucas, Milius, and Scorsese out to the warehouse to have a look at the half-completed monster shark, still on struts and suspended in slings. The thing was enormous, so big, in fact, that Milius thought the craftsmen were overdoing it. As Lucas looked over the storyboards the artists were using for reference, he felt himself becoming slightly envious. If you can get half of this on film, he told Spielberg, you're going to have the biggest hit of all time. He would be right. Soon after its 1975 release, Jaws would indeed become the highest-grossing film of all time, at least until Lucas surpassed it with Star Wars 2 years later. Ever the gadget freak, Lucas climbed a ladder and leaned into the gigantic open mouth of the shark to see how it worked, at which point Spielberg mischievously seized the controls and slowly closed the mouth on Lucas, and then couldn't get it to open again. Lucas eventually shook himself loose, and the four filmmakers fled, convinced they'd broken Universal's prized prop. By August of 1974, it had been nearly a year since Lucas had signed the deal memo with Fox for the Star Wars, and he still didn't have a formal contract. Although he had delivered the first draft of the script late, and was in danger of missing the September deadline for the second draft, that wasn't the cause of Fox's hesitation. Mostly, Fox executives were still uncertain about the budget. How much were these special effects going to cost, and how many sets would need to be built? And were foot-dragging rather than making a decision. Fucking slow, said attorney Tom Pollock bluntly. I got mad, said Lucas. Still, sensing an opportunity in the unfinished agreement, Lucas had Pollock fire off a letter to Fox on August 23rd, asking for what would turn out to be two crucial concessions. I was very careful to say, I don't want more money, Lucas explained later. I said, I don't want anything financial, but I do want the rights to make these sequels. Friends like the Hikes were aghast at Lucas's stubbornness, but then they didn't share or even understand his vision for the film. He would say, they're not giving me control, they're not giving me the rights to the sequels, recalled Willard Hike. And I'd pause and I'd say, George, you're lucky to get $10 million to make this movie. Let's just make the first one. As negotiations with Fox dragged on, Coppola stepped in with an offer Lucas found almost too attractive to ignore. After trying for the past year to land studio backing for Apocalypse Now, Coppola had finally decided to finance the movie himself, and he wanted Lucas to direct it. Coppola may have envisioned it as a collaboration of Hollywood's two hottest filmmakers. I was anxious for George Lucas to do the picture on any basis at all, Coppola told an interviewer. But Lucas wasn't ready to hitch himself to Coppola again, at least not yet. While Lucas had been working on Apocalypse Now off and on for more than 4 years, pushing it through screenplay revisions with John Milius, pitching it to glassy-eyed studio executives, and sending Kurtz to scout locations, he found he was suddenly much more interested in the Star Wars. I had this huge draft of a screenplay, said Lucas, and I had sort of fallen in love with it. Lucas turned the offer down, and while he may have hoped Coppola would still give him the opportunity to direct it later, His time for Apocalypse had passed. Coppola would take the director's chair himself, eventually spending 2 nightmarish years in the Philippines on the problem-plagued production. Lucas had other reasons to pass. For one thing, he just didn't think moviegoers needed one more angry, socially relevant film. With Watergate and Vietnam still leading the nightly newscasts and splattered across front pages everywhere, the real world already seemed angry enough. "I thought, we all know what a terrible mess we have made of the world," said Lucas. "We also know, as every movie made in the last 10 years points out, how terrible we are, how we have ruined the world, and what schmucks we are, and how rotten everything is. And I said, what we really need is something more positive." For Lucas, the idea of the Star Wars offered a different, even higher calling. "I realized there was another relevance that is even more important. Dreams and fantasies, getting children to believe there is more to life than garbage and killing and all that real stuff like stealing hubcaps, that you could still sit and dream about exotic lands and strange creatures," Lucas explained to Film Quarterly in 1977. "Once I got into Star Wars, it struck me that we had lost all that. A whole generation has grown up without fairy tales. You just don't get them anymore. And that's the best stuff in the world. Adventures in far-off lands. It's fun." At this point, then, Star Wars had become more than just a passion. It was a moral obligation. And Lucas, in his negotiations with Fox, was determined to keep hold of as much of it as he could, going after merchandising rights and commercial tie-ins, making it clear that his company would have the sole and exclusive right to use the name Star Wars for merchandising. "When I was writing, I had visions of R2-D2 mugs and little wind-up robots, but I thought that would be the end of it," Lucas recalled. "I went for the merchandising because it was one of the few things left that we hadn't discussed." But Lucas also shrewdly recognized that Fox and other studios had underestimated, and in many cases wasted, merchandising opportunities to market their films. "We found Fox was giving away merchandising rights just for the publicity," said Lucas. "They gave away tie-in promotions with a big fast food chain. They were actually paying these people to do this big campaign for them. We told them that was insane." Lucas seized his opportunity. "I simply said, I'm going to be able to make t-shirts, I'm going to be able to make posters, and I'm going to be able to sell this movie even though the studio won't. So I was able to get everything that was left over." John Milius remembered Lucas talking about the money he was certain he'd make from merchandising, bragging, "I'm going to make 5 times as much money as Francis on these science fiction toys, and I won't have to make The Godfather." Fox took its time responding to Lucas's 2 demands. While sequel and merchandising rights were generally bottom-tier clauses, Fox was still careful enough to ensure they didn't just give them away. Ultimately, however, the studio agreed with Ladd. They were willing to sign over the sequel and merchandising rights, mainly because they'd gotten the director of American Graffiti so cheaply. George never once came in and said, "Now I'm worth 10 times more than I was when you made a deal with me," said Ladd. His attitude was, "I made a deal, I'll stick with it." As Lucas put it, "I didn't ask for another $100 million, just the merchandising rights." And Fox thought that was a fair trade. Fox wasn't prepared to drop the contracts just yet. There was still the question of the film's final budget to nail down. But things were at least moving again. And no one, not even Lucas, appreciated that by securing sequel and merchandising rights, he had just negotiated for himself a $1 billion clause. Decades later, Fox executive Gareth Wiggin would shake his head in wonder at Lucas's instincts and audacity. George was enormously far-sighted, and the studio wasn't, because they didn't know the world was changing, said Wiggin. George did know the world was changing. I mean, he changed it. When it came down to it, American Graffiti saved Star Wars more than once. "The financial return from American Graffiti is nice," Kurtz remarked in 1973. "But money isn't the important thing. The success of Graffiti allows us to do what we want and have some influence in the business." That was true to some extent. The enormous success of American Graffiti had given Lucas the leverage he needed to muscle some key concessions out of Fox during contract negotiations. But Fox's concessions still hadn't produced a formal contract, and without a contract, there was no money for further development of Star Wars. At this point, then, Kurtz's statement of principle notwithstanding, money really was the important thing. If Fox wasn't going to invest in Star Wars, then Lucas would. The profits from American Graffiti would help Lucas throw Star Wars a number of lifelines critical to its further development. In late 1974, one of his first investments was in a talented model maker named Colin J. Cantwell, who had built the miniatures for 2001: A Space Odyssey and The Andromeda Strain. It would be Cantwell's job to design and build the prototypes for the many spaceships and vehicles mentioned, but only vaguely described, in Lucas's script. Lucas usually had a general idea of how a ship or vehicle should look. He wanted his spaceships to look realistic, he told Cantwell, but with a comic book nobility. And he and Cantwell would pass drawings back and forth, tinkering with details, until eventually Cantwell had a final sketch to work from. Cantwell was a real kit basher, combining parts from various plastic model kits, cars, boats, airplanes, tanks, anything, to create spaceships with an incredible amount of technical detail which looked as if they might really work. But the model maker had a keen sense of the dramatic as well. It was Cantwell who would come up with the designs for the X-Wing and TIE fighters, treating their distinctive look as a storytelling device. My premise, Cantwell explained, was that you had to instantly know the bad guys from the good guys by how a ship looks and feels. Once Cantwell's models were complete, Lucas would take them to his second and perhaps even more important new employee, artist Ralph McQuarrie, a former illustrator for Boeing whom Lucas had met through Hal Barwood and Matthew Robbins several years earlier. I'd seen some of his paintings, said Lucas, and I thought he was really brilliant. Everything in a McQuarrie painting, from characters and their clothing to buildings and battleships, looked elegant yet slightly worn, giving his work the same used universe aesthetic that Lucas had brought to THX and was hoping to repeat again in Star Wars. McQuarrie, then, was just the artist to help visualize the countless worlds and characters contained in Lucas's ambitious script. Typically, however, Lucas wasn't going to give McQuarrie entirely free rein. I just describe what I want and then he does it, was how Lucas explained their collaboration. Just as Lucas had insisted on hovering over Cantwell's work, so too would he fuss with and modify McQuarrie's rough sketches until he was at last happy with them. Only at that point would McQuarrie be permitted to paint the final image. Still, it was McQuarrie who would establish the artistic coherence of the Star Wars universe, painting fully realized exotic locations like Tatooine and Cloud City on the planet Bespin, and creating iconic character designs like the Tusken Raiders, C-3PO, R2-D2, and Darth Vader. Vader's design, in fact, had been a happy accident. The artist had given the grim-looking general a spacesuit he thought the character would need to board a spacecraft. But Lucas loved the look so much, it became the villain's regular uniform. More than anything else, however, McQuarrie's paintings would make Lucas's imagined and sometimes confusing universe that much easier for executives and others to comprehend. For Lucas, there was never any doubt about the value of McQuarrie's contribution. When words could not convey my ideas, said Lucas, I could always point to one of Ralph's fabulous illustrations and say, do it like this. McQuarrie's first painting, of primitive versions of R2-D2 and C-3PO on a desert planet, was completed on January 2, 1975, just in time for Lucas to include it in the gold embossed binder containing the latest revision of his script, which now had the lengthy title Adventures of the Starkiller, Episode 1, The Star Wars. I think they, the paintings, were done as a substitute for arm-waving and verbal descriptions, and to start budget talks, said McQuarrie. That was probably true, as Lucas and Fox were still squabbling over the projected costs of the film. Part of the problem was that the script kept growing, with new locations, new characters, and new battles added in every draft. It got to be a very fat script, agreed Lucas, and the story had gotten away from me. In this latest draft, Lucas had more carefully fleshed out the concept of the Force, still called the Force of Others in this version, dividing it neatly into a good side called Ashla and a bad side called Bogan. He had also decided that the Force could be intensified through the possession of a mystical kyber crystal, Lucas's first, but by no means last, great MacGuffin. The concept of the Force was an important one in the story, said Kurtz, and the difficulty is trying to create a religious spiritual concept that works in a very simple way without heavy exposition. Unfortunately, Lucas's reliance on heavy exposition was still a problem. Though things were getting better, Lucas had decided to make 3PO and R2 more central to the story. His ongoing nod to the two peasant farmers who had held together the hidden fortress. But it was a decision that annoyed Coppola, who thought Lucas was turning the story into comedy. He had a whole script that I thought was fine, and then he chucked it, said Coppola. He was interested in the two servants. Coppola remained more intrigued by the idea of a teenaged princess at the center of the story. But Lucas had thrown that out too, downgrading Leia to Luke's cousin in the new draft, and then all but writing her out of the plot. Instead, he chose to concentrate on a mighty Jedi warrior known as the Starkiller and his family of sons. This time, Luke is prompted into action when he receives a hologram message from his brother Deke, who asks Luke to bring the kyber crystal to their wounded father, the Starkiller. Luke hires Han Solo, now a burly bearded but ruggedly handsome boy, pretty much Coppola as a star pilot, and his co-pilot Chewbacca, resembling a huge gray bush baby monkey, to take him to Cloud City, where Deke is now being held prisoner. Luke and Han rescue Deke, escape with the Death Star in pursuit, then head for Yavin, where they use the kyber crystal to revive the Starkiller. Luke leads an assault on the Death Star, and though he isn't the one to fire the fatal shot that destroys the space station, Luke returns to Yavin a hero, to lead a revolution at the side of his father. And now that Lucas had brought up the sequel rights, he wanted to make it clear that he intended to use them, as a final roll-up title promises that the Starkiller and his family will be back soon in The Perilous Search for the Princess of Ondos. He'd get to the princess in the next film.